Texas at Austin. And her talk is also connected to ethnographic collections, particularly she's talking about the ethnomusicologist Bascom Lamar Lunsford, who worked on North Carolina folk songs. So we'll get that presentation up. Okay, do you just want this? Okay.
Thank you, Aaron. Before I start, I think this is a great progression of presentations because I'll be talking about, you know, after establishing physical and intellectual control over collections, making preservation plans, I'll be talking about attempting to provide access in the spirit that Mr. Seeger spoke about eloquently to a particular collection at Columbia University. And my co-presenter was not able to make it today. She's actually in Kentucky doing some research for this project, unfortunately. But we wrote this presentation together, Jenny Halperin. She's not able to make it. And this is Bascom Lamar Lunsford, just a visual for you. In 1935, Appalachian insider ethnomusicologist Bascom Lamar Lunsford traveled to Columbia University from his native North Carolina to record his famed Memory Collection, a collection of over 315 songs, folk tales, dance calls, and reflections. Lunsford, a lawyer, performer, folklorist, and jack of all trades, recorded the songs over 2 weeks, apparently from memory, and in 7 groups. As Lunsford explains in his recorded introduction to the collection, the groups are, in his words, English and Scottish ballads of the child collection, English ballads not found in the child collection, some indigenous to North Carolina and Southern Appalachia, love songs, songs of home and of sentiment, white spirituals, Negro spirituals, and folk games, folk readings and poetry, and songs based upon some known happening, either in my own home section of Southern Appalachia or farther away, where the facts upon which songs are based are generally known. The recording was done at the behest of Dorothy Scarborough, professor of English at Columbia, and after her death, was passed to George Hibbett, also of the English department, and the recording engineer was Walter Garwick, who also worked, perhaps more famously, with John Lomax. According to primary sources, there were 2 copies of the recordings made on 79 12-inch aluminum discs, recorded on separate Fairchild machines. Columbia's original discs have most likely been lost, but there remains a complete set once belonging to Lunsford, now held at Mars Hill College near Asheville. In all, there remain 9 legitimate copies of the archive, the Lunsford originals at Mars Hill, Columbia's originals, and a copy at the Library of Congress. And there are 6 copies dubbed onto tape at the Library of Congress, Indiana University, Mars Hill, Berea College, the University of North Carolina, and at Columbia. Sometime in the 1940s, Columbia's copy of the collection was folded into the larger Columbia University Ethnomusicology Archives, owned and mostly recorded by Laura Bolton, an ethnomusicologist who traveled and made many field recordings around the US. This copy of the archive does not contain 5 to 10 lost songs that have been identified, and we've primarily been working with the Columbia University tape dub that was digitized in WAV format onto hard drive in 2000. So to give you a sense of the collection, I'm going to play 2 examples. In the first selection, Lunsford describes the collection as non-commercial. His approach to folk music was entirely free access, and indeed he only made 2 commercial recordings in his life. In a sense, Lunsford's words and legacy are the guiding principle for our whole endeavor with this collection, in which we aim to create free and open access to his memory collection.
I found that song in the heart of a friend. I submit these records with the usual restriction upon these records. They are not to be used for commercial purposes. This, March 3rd, 1935, Bascom Lamar Lunsford, minstrel of the Appalachians, recording for Columbia University in New York City.
This this collection is considered a sort of holy grail of Appalachian musicology for several reasons. Lunsford is of particular interest to academics because of his relationship with the academy through his education and academic interest in folklore. Over the course of his life, he collected over 3,000 lyric sheets of different tunes, soliciting from friends, acquaintances, and through the newspaper. His playing style also bridged the gap between old style and bluegrass, and his Mountain Dance and Folk Festival was the first music festival that championed American music, and it's still going on today. This tune that I'm going to play next appears on Harry Smith's Anthology of American Folk Music, but is given quite a different context by Lunsford's introduction, and it sounds different if you've heard. This is the end of Lunsford's introduction to the song and the beginning of it. It's called Dry Bones.
He was a wonderful preacher. He had a sermon on dry bones, which was very effective, and it's wonderful to see the effect on a great Negro audience when he would deliver one of his masterful sermons. This is a song that was brought to that country about the time this Negro lived. Dry bones. Dry bones in the valley. Get up and take a little walk. The deaf could hear, and the dumb could talk. I saw the light come shining, I saw the light come down. Adam and Eve in the garden.
Our main goal as custodians of this collection is to provide access to the recordings as widely and openly as possible. We'll do this by creating a widely accessible web exhibit for the collection. So in the pursuit of this goal, we face a number of challenges. First, in order to provide the best access to audio material, we want to attain the best possible copies of the aluminum disc recordings and create good-sounding digital versions of every song, rather than using the rather low-quality tape dubs that already exist. This is problematic in two ways. First, the aluminum discs in best condition are the ones owned by Mars Hill College. Columbia's institutional repository is happy to preserve the digital copies we will make, but in order to do this, we need explicit ownership rights to go to Columbia. This means that Mars Hill will have to give up their rights to the recordings, which they're hesitant to do, understandably. Why would an institution in Asheville, near where Lunsford was from and where he did his work, give their only copies of important Lunsford recordings to an institution in New York? Second, the redigitization process is expensive. Using Safe Sound Audio, digitization of all 14 hours of songs from the fragile and rare format will cost about $15,000, and that's money that has to be raised with the cooperation of Mars Hill. Another area of challenge is the wishes of the Lunsford family, Bascom's descendants, who are, in a sense, also the owners of his work and legacy. In an email exchange with the family, we learned some of their concerns with releasing the song collection into the digital domain. One family member wrote, "There needs to be a sensitivity to political correctness. I haven't heard all of the cuts, but I assume there is use of the N-word on some. There may be other ethnic slights that don't play well today." Another wrote, "He was a product of his time, and his work reflects those values." Also, it's very important to the family that Lunsford's work is made very accessible to the common man. This shouldn't be a research tool created with only outside scholars in mind. Folk music is people's music, and this idea is the inspiration for our project of creating a web exhibit for the Lunsford Memory Collection. Our goal in this endeavor is access, balanced with respect for the autonomy of our partner institutions and their interests, and in general, issues of sensitivity and repatriation. We envision a simple layout for the web exhibit, providing easy access and a portal to all of Lunsford's life and recordings, not solely the Columbia collection. Because he didn't make many commercial recordings, Lunsford is a somewhat forgotten figure of the Appalachian folk tradition, but we hope to bring his life and vision to the forefront through this approach. Lunsford's collection challenges some canonical ideas about Appalachian folk through the diversity of the songs and the inclusion of little-known variants. We hope to use the website to promote a new canon of American folk that similarly encompasses variety, collaboration, and ease of access. So how do we, as archivists, create a website that combines user participation with the expert opinion of scholars in the field? In a solely digital archive, can we integrate the two? And as outsiders, can we successfully maintain and convey the values of Appalachian culture? As we thought about our goals for providing access to the Lunsford collection, we looked at research and archival studies and experiments in making archival material accessible and interactive on the internet. The goal of the archivist is to consider archival documents or objects as evidence of some human activity, either the functioning of an organization or events in the course of an individual's life. The archivist decides what is kept in the archive and arranges and describes this material according to established principles, which usually center around the context of creation or provenance. She also creates a document, a finding aid, to help researchers understand the evidential meanings of the objects. In doing these activities, the archivist has the power to shape history and our enduring perceptions of it. Traditional static arrangement and description don't account for the fact that objects, documents, even songs can have many interpretations and uses over the course of their lives. Current literature and archival studies calls for the archivist to open up these processes, allowing in multiple voices and multiple perspectives and accounts of history. Inviting the user to participate in these processes through the internet is one way to do this. Some recent endeavors to this end include community-based appraisal, where a community determines the account of their own history that is preserved, and socially navigable finding aids, where you can see the footprints of users who were there before you, showing how they navigated the collection and even reading comments that they left. Another example is the use of the photo hosting site Flickr to invite users to participate in photo archives. Both the Library of Congress and the Smithsonian have been involved in this. Through Flickr, the general public is invited to view photos, leave comments, and assign descriptive freeform verbal tags that remain linked to the photos for other users to see. The Library of Congress reported that through tags and comments, people contributed specialist knowledge, added value to the photos with links, comparisons, and notes, reflected on related experiences from all over the world, offered visual humor, and sparked creativity, memory, and conversations about history, helping each other to understand the images and data provided by the Library of Congress and their historical context. So why have photo collections been particularly good sites for these experiments? Photos can benefit from user-provided information for the following reasons. Images are useful to researchers from many disciplines with differing perspectives. The same image can mean different things to different people. And images can have several layers of meaning, from specific to more abstract or symbolic. When you think about it, these same things can be said about many textual documents, and especially about music. Music has wide appeal, invites different interpretations, and can have both specific and abstract meanings at the same time. So the benefits of our project here are multiple. The Lunsford songs provide intriguing material for experimentation, furthering research on interactive online archives for the purposes of providing access to the collection. We were inspired by interactive and participatory archives that were able to spark dialogue, build a community of knowledge and interest, and even solve some mysteries about the content or identity of material in archival collections. In accordance with our goals to maintain and convey the values of the Appalachian tradition, comply with the family's wishes to appeal to the common person, and keep these songs in use rather than as static archival objects, we feel that user participation could be a great benefit to the Lunsford collection. As in photo collections on Flickr, the knowledge and passion of people interested in the Lunsford songs can be a great resource in providing context and meaning to the songs. So first, we would like the songs to be available to download for free by anyone who wants them. We would like to provide some expert-sourced information as a jumping-off point of context for the songs, but we would like each song to have its own comment section where visitors of the website can help interpret lyrics, chords, and meaning of the songs and share these with others. Musicians can upload or link to their own or other versions of each song. And a geospatial map feature will show where and when each song was discovered by Lunsford and covered by others. This will result in a sense of a song's development over history, showing that these versions, while being preserved as archival, are no more authoritative than any of their preceding or succeeding variants. These songs were collected through collaboration and participation with many musicians and should continue to live on in that context, open for reinterpretation far into the future. In addition, Lunsford, who is called the minstrel of the Appalachians, recounts the physical beauty of his beloved mountains to create moods throughout the recordings. Sensitively addressing environmental degradation in the Appalachian Mountains could be another aspect to the site, furthering its interdisciplinary appeal and its potential as a teaching tool for environmental studies and geography as well. We hope that creating a website with social features will begin to build a community of interest around the Lunsford songs that will attract all kinds of people, Appalachian scholars, musicians of all sorts, music appreciators, and even casual browsers of the internet. We don't expect every visitor to the website to participate in finding new interpretations of the songs. Participation by listening is enough to help the legacy of Lunsford live on and not be forgotten. So I'm going to now play a few more examples from the collection. First, I'll play two examples with generally acceptable sound quality and some really prime examples of Lunsford's performance. The first one is called Doggett's Gap, and Lunsford plays banjo on this track.
Doggett's Gap. Chestnut tree full of chestnut sap, snow knee deep in the Doggett Gap. I'm a-going up hollering around by my trap, about take dinner in the Doggett Gap. I'm breaking up the ground, a gonna pinch a crab, getting something started in the Doggett Gap.
And this next one is called Shout Louie, and it has a great Lunsfordian introduction.
Always been a delight of mine to go high into the mountains and spend the night with the mountaineer in the mountain cabin in his little mud-daub happy home, take down the old tack-head banjo and sing Shout Louie. Shout, little Louie, shout your best, your old grandma's gone to rest. To bed, she never got to hear what her grandma said. Shout, little Lulu, shout, shout.
Now, here's one more example. This one is called Sifting Sands, and it's a little more problematic in a couple of ways, representative of some of the challenges of this project. First, as you'll see, the audio suffers from a lot of skipping that occurred during the production of the tape dub master, which is why we need to redigitize the collection from the original discs before releasing it online. And also, if you listen carefully, this is one of the songs that might raise some sensitivity issues that Lunsford's descendants were concerned about.
Cutting and corn and the white folk takes the money. Sally in the garden, sifting sand, Kitty in the pot with a fog eye man.
So the sound quality of that fiddle doesn't sound that great either. So now I'd like to talk a bit about the current state of the Lunsford archive. We're currently using a content management software called Collective Access to design a prototype website that will include all of the interactive features that we've envisioned for the collection. We plan to elicit the help of some established experts in beginning to build a base of knowledge for the site that we hope will spark interest and dialogues. Appalachian scholars such as David Wisnant and Grill Marcus and Loyal Jones, who is Lunsford's biographer and friend. Eventually, we will raise funding for a professional web developer to create the final site. Meanwhile, we are still trying to get funding to redigitize the disks, and we are collaborating with Mars Hill and applying for grants. We hope to have some funding come through next year to begin this process, and we also hope that an ongoing collaboration and dialogue with them will begin to break down some barriers of legal and conceptual ownership that may heed the process of providing wide access and permanent preservation for the songs. So in short, this site is rather an experiment. We hope it will further research about interactive archives and further understanding of the way people use them and how interactivity can be used to strengthen and expand the societal functions of archives and archivists, allowing more voices and perspectives to be heard and preserved. We hope that our experiences, once shared, can help other archival repositories, especially ones with small collections of music, to get their collections on the web and into the digital public realm in ways that foster community and creative use. And most importantly, given time and funding, this endeavor will ultimately provide access to this great and valuable collection. And if I have another minute left, I'll play one more song. This is probably the most well-known song that Lunsford is credited with, called Mountain Dew, so some of you may know it.
Oh, my first day in court, I wish to report. Then witness a story so true. When the state closed its case, a young man raised his face and began all the facts to review. They call it that old Mountain Dew, and those who refuse it are few. While I know I've done wrong, the temptation is strong when they call for that Mountain Dew. Oh, the deacon drove by in his auto so shy, said his family was down with and he thought that I ought to just get him a quart of good old Mountain Dew. Yes, he called it that old Mountain Dew.
Don't fade out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Emily. We have a few minutes for some questions.
Lunsford's documents are all at Mars Hill College and Berea College in Kentucky. And I think that any papers that correspond with these recordings specifically are also subsumed in that collection, probably at Mars Hill. We haven't. But we would really like this site to be a portal to that kind of thing. And as well as, you know, photos and things like that that I think could really enhance this collection, which is part of why, you know, it's very important to have a partnership with those kinds of institutions. And, you know, that's very possible in the digital realm. So. We have corresponded with SafeSound about that. I know that they wrote up a proposal for us about how it would be done. And actually, my colleague is the one who corresponded with them, but I did see that report. Mm-hmm. Did you have a specific question about that? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Noted. Okay.
Any other questions?
Yeah. I'm scratching my head. I'm trying to remember. What labels did he do his commercial recording? Was one of four ways?
I'm not sure, actually. Someone else in the room might know.
Yeah, I should know, too.
Okay. Great. Well, hopefully within, you know, a year or two, if all goes well, this will all be available. So, you know, check back if you're interested.
I have one question since we have a minute. Mm-hmm. So it's a really great idea. I love the idea of having these available as a not just something that's presented, but like you said, an interactive archive, because it's so much a part of our heritage and our national heritage. But at the same time, the performances are Lunsford's, and given his stated restrictions on the recordings. These are not to be used for commercial purposes. If you're making them available for download, how do you protect against them being abused? You know, of course, you wouldn't be, this project wouldn't be doing anything like that, but, mm-hmm. but how do you protect them from abuse from others who can take them and issue them commercially, reinterpret them in ways that, especially if the family's already concerned, is that something that you've taken into account, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I guess I should have mentioned we plan on making them available under a Creative Commons license. Mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't, you know, that won't prevent the songs from being abused if mm-hmm. if they're going to be. But that's one step to be taken, a Creative Commons license that asks for, you know, if these songs are reused in any way for attribution, we would specify they are not to be used for commercial purposes, and that they're not to be altered and republished in an altered form. I think we would go that route. So, I mean, that's one preventative step. You know, I mean, I guess that's like a big question of the internet, and having things in digital form at all makes it so much easier for them to be appropriated in ways that may not be productive.
It's one of the questions that comes up and is a bit of a dividing line between archives, particularly ethnographic archives, and libraries that deal with commercial materials, where the commercial materials were meant to be circulated far mm-hmm. and wide and monetized. The ethnographic ones were generally not. And so the idea of access is a bit different. And I think even with Lunsford himself saying on the recording, you know, this is not to be used for commercial purposes, to me that would not necessarily negate making it available for download, but you would want to try to find out, maybe by talking to the family, what were his reasons for saying that? Mm-hmm. Maybe it was just that he didn't want them issued right then for commercial purposes because they would interfere, he thought, with sales of his actual commercial recordings, or you know, there might have been reasons that you could rationalize. Okay, now in 2011, it's probably okay to do that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point and an interesting interpretation.
Yeah.
I think that, I guess the way that we interpreted that was, as opposed to commercial purposes, they were to be used for scholarly purposes mm-hmm. and learning purposes and sharing purposes. But, you know, that's true. There could be other interpretations of that.
The answer may be in his papers.
True, yeah.
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 Okay. I would think it might be cultural, mountain culture, from that area, not not wanting to be ripped off,
mm-hmm.
knowing
mm-hmm.
that there were commercial companies that would otherwise pay, and he was not doing it for those purposes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess we hope that making these recordings widely accessible for free would be in the same spirit as that.
Why he recorded them in the first place, yeah.
And speaking with the family and, you know, those closest to him and his work would be probably the best way to determine that, as well as looking at his papers.
Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you all for your comments.